that absolutely think I had this cape and that I was like the superhero. I have this image that I save on my camera roll because it's a picture of my kitchen floor in our old home where there are kebab sticks and popcorn kernels like all over the floor. And at the time, my nearly 10-year-old, but pushing boundary two-year-old, she'd like climbed up the pantry and the kebab sticks and corn kernels were like freaking everywhere. I always use that as a metaphor where at work or in my role as chief executive, particularly in the early days, like you wanted to give this, everything's fine. Everything is fine. Maybe that's why people, they're like, oh my gosh, she's incredible. And it's like, go home and look at my kitchen floor.
There's a saying, what got you here won't get you there. And as cliched as it sounds, there's a strong element of truth to that. Wherever you are now in your leadership career, you're going to need to keep evolving, to keep learning. And that's the topic at the heart of my conversation today with my guest, Monique Davidson. She became one of New Zealand's youngest chief executives in local government at the age of 29, and nearly a decade on, she's leading Horowhenua District Council, and she's honest about what that decade has taught her. So many lessons. We get into the idea of ego, about the cape that leaders wear without even realizing it, and this photo on her phone that says a lot about how she thinks about leadership. I reckon this episode's going to stay with you. I found we went deep quickly, and we went into some really rich territory. I'm Digby Scott, and this is Dig Deeper, a podcast where I have conversations with depth that'll change the way you lead. Hey, Monique, welcome to the show.
Hey, Digby, it's good to be here.
Yeah, I'm really pleased that you made the time because you are in the thick of a whole lot of stuff at the moment. A question I want to start with is, you were the youngest CEO, I think, in New Zealand in local government when you were first appointed, which is a little while ago now.
Yeah, back in the heyday.
Yeah, totally. The question I've got is, what got you to the top? And let's call it top, and we can debate that topic. What got you to the top won't be the thing that keeps you evolving from here, right? When I say that, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, and I'd love to unpack the whole, what do we mean by when we say we're at the top? But my reaction to that is, that's a bit confronting, right? Because how I got to the top versus how do I sustain myself for the next 35 years of my career requires this deep reflection about, oh gosh, what am I going to have to become? What do I need to do differently? Maybe it's that story about how do we evolve?
Well, I think actually you've just named something. Can we just talk about top?
Yeah.
Because it does reflect some thinking about hierarchy and positioning and all this stuff. So let's talk a little bit about the top because, you know, you are the CEO. And in many people's eyes, that says, well, you're at the top. What's wrong with that language, do you think?
I think the 29-year-old when I was appointed chief executive, and maybe even like prior to that when I was hungry for this idea of getting to the top, it's got this attraction to the ego, right? And maybe the idea of getting to the top, maybe we could better describe it as like being our best in the season that we're in at that point in time. And so at 29, probably for a whole lot of reasons that reflected the tradition of local government in New Zealand, the idea of a young woman in her 20s being a chief executive, lots of people would have described that as being at the top or being the young gun. But when I think about where I am now and where am I going to be in 30 years' time, it's like, well, the top might look quite different. Well, the top might feel quite different because what matters to me or how I keep having influence and impact is kind of less about the title, right? And less about the hierarchy and more about, have I made a difference?
Yeah. You know, there's this phrase that's going around in my head, which is there's something about shifting from proving yourself to improving yourself. I think it was Adam Grant who said that. I wonder whether that's the shift that you're thinking about. And I'm curious, you know, when you were at 29 or around that age, how much was it about I can prove to myself that I can do this? Because I'm not hearing that in your language now. This is more about, well, okay, where do I put my effort to have more influence and impact? How much of it was it back then about, let's just see if I can do this?
Oh, I think it was a lot about that. I think it was also a lot about proving to others or proving to the system, the institution, that kind of challenging the status quo. And I bring it back to this idea of what I thought I needed and what might have mattered to me. And there were lots of things that mattered to me, and I don't want to come across as kind of disingenuous, but I think my ego mattered a lot more than it does now. So I love that going from proving ourselves to improving. I think I'm absolutely in that space of like every day, how am I 1% better? Or every day, how am I creating space to learn, to listen, to be something a little bit different? And that is about an acceptance that it's not about my ego anymore. And that's not because I don't have an ego. Like, I've got one.
We all got one.
We've all got one. Yeah, totally. But I think time, experience, and a bit of reflection over the years has helped me build a healthy relationship with my ego.
What does that look like? Because, yeah, we all have an ego. Does it have us or do we have it? You know, and if it has us, that's the proving piece, I reckon. You know, whereas if we have it, we can go, okay, well, there's the ego thing. What's your relationship with your ego like now? How's that show up?
It's healthy. I look back at young moments of me. I think it tells a little bit about maybe my journey into leadership, which has often been led through kind of a service lens. You kind of think about it when we're at school and as a young adult, often it's been those opportunities to get involved in not-for-profit type stuff or kind of wear the badge that I think was ingrained in me, this idea of servant but ego-led leadership. And I can think of moments early on in my career where I had this confidence that some days now I'm like, oh, I wish I still had that.
Is it kind of an ignorant confidence? Is that what you mean by that? Or is it?
Yeah, I think like not an arrogant confidence, yeah. Ignorant confidence. I think it was an eagerness confidence. It was a little bit of a kind of bulletproof confidence. Mm-hmm. You only know what you know. And yeah, a whole lot of naivety.
That's the word, naive confidence. Yeah. Yes.
But then I can think of moments in my journey where, you know, and this isn't, it's not like it's an even thing every day, right? It goes up and down. But I can think of moments where you feel such a sense of obligation and duty to serve the people that you are leading, to serve the community. I can think of times where I have crushed my ego, and that's not helped my confidence. It's created moments of imposter syndrome. It's challenged my assumptions of who I thought I was. But I'm grateful for those moments because I think that's what's helped me lean into the, how do I find this balance where I back myself, I believe in myself, as cliche as it sounds, like I love myself.
Yeah.
But I'm not naive about it. I'm not all about me, but I'm not totally undermining who I am and what I know I'm capable of in order to not actually be the grounded leader I need to be.
Grounded's the word, isn't it? You know, I often think about you want the healthy balance between confidence and wonderance. You know, confidence is like, I've got this, I know this, I'm experienced. You know, maybe I haven't done this before, but I know I'm resourceful enough to navigate it, that stuff. And then the wonderance, it's just the, what can I learn here? And what don't I know? And what assumptions have I got? And, you know, where are my blind spots? And all of that stuff. So all of those end with a question mark. So there's kind of like this curiosity, but also a groundedness. And I think that sounds like where you're at now, whereas before it might have been a bit more on the naive confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
And less of the wonderance.
And I think our institutions and our systems and how we frame leadership has given us this false sense of purpose that in leadership you have all the answers And in leadership, you reassure and you, if you don't know, you're going to kind of pretend you do know. And I think particularly in the public sector and the local government system, finding the space, I don't know if fail is the right word, but finding the space to explore, to do some ideation, to be curious about what does it feel like when you don't have the answers and you create the space for other people to answer the questions. That's where maybe we get to start thinking about leadership differently in the sense of people don't always need me. It feels good when people need you though, right, Digby?
It's not just the systems that are expecting us to have answers. It's our, again, I reckon this ego is coming back through there. It's like, oh man, people need me? Cool. I'm valuable. And it's seductive.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Love.
Yeah. 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 So grounded is about not needing to have that be your driver, that need to be needed in that way. You know, we all have it, right? A sense of belonging. We need to feel like we matter. Yet if that's driving us, if that has us, then we can be in this doom loop of be the answer provider, being the hero. And you're saying we can't be that.
No, we've got to take the capes off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think our good friend Alicia Mackay talks about that. Like, how do we take the capes off?
That's right.
But in order to take the cape off, like, we've got to let go of our ego, but not let it on the floor for everyone to walk over and crush.
Exactly.
Store it away in the costume box for when we might need it.
And you do need it sometimes. How do you deal with that? Like, the pressures both externally as well as internally to be the hero. What's your approach, or what has helped you leave the cape off more than you put it on?
Yeah, I've always been a really strong believer, even when I was kind of in the naive, confident phase of my leadership journey, that you put great people around you. And when you put great people around you, you implicitly trust them, but create the space for them to be their very best. And I think I've got exceptional people around me, which means that I don't need to pretend to be everything or don't need to be everywhere. I'm creating a space for others to fly. I think the trick, though, is that making sure they then don't put the cape on. Yeah, maybe that's a conversation for another rainy day. So, yeah, certainly for me, it's surrounding myself with great people. There is something about being deliberate in acknowledging or naming it at times. We often tell good stories when things go well, and we often might pass over the story where there was a learning opportunity. So I do find myself at times acknowledging that in this moment, there's a reason why the cape is coming off, or there's a reason that we're creating the space. And that's because we want there to be discomfort, or we want there to be a learning opportunity. Because otherwise, we're allowing the system to keep thinking that leaders always have to wear the cape. We make it about the people, right? Instead of about the processes or the system, which is going to endure beyond the people.
Yes, nicely put. You talked about stories. Could you tell us a story about where you had the cape on for perhaps a little too long?
Like, I look back at my career and, you know, my first chief executive role was at a small local authority in New Zealand. We did exceptional work. We had a high-performing team that needed to shift an organisation and a community that had kind of been stuck in a particular context. But I look back at where the organisation was when I arrived and where the organisation was when I left. And my reflection is that I wonder how much of that progress was reliant on one, two, three, or four leaders that kept wearing the cape. And I wouldn't call it a regret, but I think if I was to have my time again, I absolutely would have taken that cape off sooner. And I would have been deliberate in ensuring other people took the cape off so that we could have embedded continuous improvement. We could have embedded further progress that wasn't reliant on just one, two, three, or four people. like I've kind of generalized there to make a point because I don't think it was as binary or black and white as that. But that's probably like a macro example. Like I held that and I don't think the community lost out because of that, but we could have maybe achieved more had I not held it.
I want to ask you, what was the cost? I'm not sure that's the right question, but there's something about, you said if we have our time again, I wouldn't have done it that way. Clearly, well, what I'm reading between the lines is the outcome was good, yet there was a, is it an opportunity cost or was it a cost to those three or four leaders? What do you reckon the cost was?
Maybe if I could talk about me, because I possibly don't want to talk on behalf of others, but, and this kind of goes back to the, how we started this conversation about how I got to the top. Is it going to be how I stay at the top? It kind of sounds a bit naff, but you know.
Yes. I asked the question, so I'll own that.
I'm in my 30s. I have two young children. Well, they don't like to be called young anymore, but I think they're still young. When I started as a chief executive at 29, I had a three-month-old. She's about to turn 10. The way I've worked over the last 10 years is not the way I can work for the next 30 years. If I'm going to have lasting impact in whatever communities I serve, whatever sector I serve, but to be the mum that I want to be the wife that I want to be, or to be the influence in my community or family. And so I think some of the at what cost is like I've put work in front of a lot of stuff in the last 10 years and like not in a way where I think I've created trauma for my children, but in a way where the improved version of Monique is so much more mindful around that, well, why did I do that? And was that because I wanted to be needed? Or was that because I thought that being seen to do that thing or doing that thing was what was actually needed or what could have been created had I stepped back? And was it really that urgent? Was it really that important?
So you're learning to check yourself. You know, you're learning to pause. I'm actually noticing in the way we're having a conversation, you know, you're not rushing in to fill the void. There's a pregnant pause often before you answer. And I'm trying to imagine 10 years ago having a conversation with you. My imagining is that you'd probably be rushing in a little bit quicker.
Yeah, I was a young gun.
Yeah, that's the word.
I was quick to answer stuff. I was self-assured. And I loved that version of me. I imagine there were people that probably worked with me or around me that was like, oh, she'll learn. She'll get it in time.
And
I reckon they'd watch this conversation and be like, oh, she's matured. but I don't think that that was wrong. What I love about this version of Monique that is reflective, poised, a little bit more deliberate is that I would have never had this sort of conversation for people to hear because I would have wanted to create an impression that I had it all together and that perfection was my story, not progress.
The question I want to ask is not what impression do you want people to have of you now, because that's a kind of an ego-y question in a way. It's more what do you hope people are hearing and thinking and reflecting on as they hear us talk or hear you talk now?
I heard a quote a few weeks back. I don't think I'm going to say it as inspiring as I recall hearing it, but like imagine if our actions were written in the sky for all to see. I've been reflecting on it, not because I think that we need to live every moment of every day so that people can judge what we do, but why I've been reflecting on it is the obligation, the burden, the opportunity that exists in leadership roles where whether you write your actions in the sky for all to see or not, how we talk, what we do, people will write that in the sky for us anyway.
Yes.
I think for those listening, there's kind of two frames that I put across that is one, as leaders, how are we creating a culture and space for people to talk about having more compassion for other leaders and just kind of softening the environment so that we're not so hard on ourselves and each other to demand perfection, but actually to inspire progress? Because we expect a lot of leaders and we look up, we always look up. And I think the higher you are up in the organization are, let's say you're at the top, the more people that you have looking up.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about how we kind of take that metaphor for imagine our actions we've written in the sky to see. Like imagine if our judgment was written in the sky for all to see, and how this idea of how we judge people and how we judge leadership and its relationship with ego as opposed to values and actions. I don't know if I really answered your question there. I feel like I went on a bit of a trail.
Yeah, that's why it's called Dig Deeper, because we go and you discover stuff the further you dig, right? It's great. I think what you've given me and us listening is something to really chew on. You know, it's that word compassion for leaders. I think, you know, if I think of any leader, you know, the further up you look, you know, towards the top, what I've learned is just see them as a human doing the best that they can do. It's interesting, that word. I wrote a LinkedIn post a couple of days ago on the spur of the moment. It was essentially, remember that everyone's dealing with their stuff. And, you know, you might have someone that you are judging or, you know, maybe even haven't seen for a while and you're imagining how they're going and what they're doing. But how do you know? And how do you know how they're going? And it got a huge amount of engagement, that post. It was like, it took me about a minute to write. I posted it 5 minutes later. And I think deep down we know that that's what we need to be able to bring to when we're thinking about someone else, we're working with a leader, whoever it might be. Yet there's something about that demanding perfection and demanding, I want to say that there's something about shifting responsibility to the other that isn't theirs to bear. You know, and I think when you're at the top and people are looking at you, perhaps there's a bit of that. And, you know, it reminds me of that JFK quote, you know, not ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And how do you shift the lens and the conversation towards, okay, well, we all have a part to play here rather than you being the hero? It probably starts with taking the cape off yourself. Now, I'm just reflecting on what I've been saying, going, where did that take the conversation? I'm wondering, what's your response to what I'm out loud extroverting there?
I think there's a natural tension when you're in an environment where you got to deliver. There's results to be achieved. There's outcomes to be achieved. And I wonder if some of your listeners might be curious about that kind of tension that will exist between not getting it right all the time or showing some vulnerability that you might not know it all, or that you want to create the space where it's okay to make mistakes or be like, yeah, no, that was not a good day for me. As you talked, I was kind of reflecting on, often we produce things as if they are binary. You're either that or that, but you're not. This is finding a balance, and it's the sprinkling of everything. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, because we can't just create the space for what some people might describe as fluffy conversations all the time, or, you know, some deeper meaningfuls. I don't think that's the conversation you and I are having. It's like, we've got to deliver, and we've got to create and empower organizations that every day are set up for success to maximize outcomes, whatever the setting they operate in. You know, might be a profit-driven organization, it might be a public sector-led organization. But we know all the research and all the storytelling is that you don't do that by pretending you're perfect or demanding perfection in a system that doesn't recognize that actually, like, we're all people, we're all human.
Yeah. The way I'd sum that up is balanced delivery and discovery. It's like, yeah, we need to deliver. That's kind of what the deal is. Yet you can't do that without a strong element of discovery conversations. And it might be one question. It might be, what do we learn this week, you know, from what we delivered and how we delivered it? And what would that mean we might do the same of or differently next week? And just by that one question, you're shaping a different relationship to the work, you know. So delivery and discovery to me. What are you discovering at the moment? Yeah, another way to put that is, what are you bumping up against in your own leadership and the learning there that you're either wrestling with, grappling with, or starting to go, I'm starting to learn this now?
We kind of touched on it around the kind of creating the space for others and being comfortable in the uncomfortable. I have an action bias. I have a how do I fix it bias. The journey I've been on is such where I don't need me to be doing it. I don't need to be in the room or in the space, but I expect others to be in. And so some of the kind of what I'm bumping up against, but getting comfortable with, is the being far more patient and working really hard to not answer the questions, but creating a culture of curiosity where I might be asking questions in a way that encourages people to answer them, not to me, but to themselves.
Yeah, it's not that you're looking for the answer, right or wrong or otherwise. It's to get them to think. If I was a fly on the wall and I was in a room with you doing that, what would be an example of a question you might ask? Or what do I hear?
A recent example is potentially a controversial one, but going through some final end of year pay and performance stuff inside our business. And The question I've asked of our executive leadership team is, how would it feel if I told you we were going to produce these results on the front page of the newspaper? We're not going to, but how would that feel? What would it look like? What are the things that come up for us when we think about that?
And what's your intent with that question?
To encourage the leadership table to not just be focusing on the decision, but to really be exploring the process we've gone through to make a decision, the lens they might be coming from, and trying to think about it through the eyes of others. I'm also deliberately trying to create a bit of disruption.
Yep, bit of heat.
Just turn the temperature up. Not because I think it's fun, not because I think we've got a whole lot of time to do it, but because I know that when we have harder conversations, when we are a bit more curious and vulnerable with each other, our egos are all balanced together.
Yeah. It's a beautiful invitation, that question, to dial down the ego. There's compassion in that. You don't have the answer to that question either. How would it feel? You're not going to be able to tell them whether they're right or wrong. You're inviting them to have a look at themselves. You're saying you're learning this. What helps you stay in that mode rather than cape mode or hero mode?
I'm being far more deliberate in the way I'm planning my days.
Okay.
To create space and time just to think. And when you've got an action bias, like, that's not a comfortable space. I am always envious of those stories of people that kind of plan 80% of their day and they've got 20% to kind of do whatever comes up. And I'm like one of those people that overplan, like plan 120% of my day, trying to cram everything in. But
yep.
I
know that.
What I've learned through some recent study, getting away from the day-to-day time on the dance floor and getting back up onto the balcony, is I find joy in thinking and I find joy in forming an opinion, and I find joy in kind of questioning with myself and just forming thoughts. And that's not something that my day-to-day job necessarily allows all the time, because you're reactive, and even when you're not reactive, you're trying to be proactive and you're thinking it through a strategy and tactics lens. You're not thinking it through, how do I look after me? There's some kind of practical stuff I'm doing around half an hour very early in the morning where I wouldn't call it journaling, because I'm actually planning my day, but I'm writing notes about what I think.
Love that.
And what I feel. And it means that I'm having to slow down, but that doesn't mean I'm less effective or efficient. If anything, I'm doing more because I'm more deliberate in what I think about what I'm doing.
Yeah, there's less diffusion of energy, actually. It's more focused energy. You're giving that time to help you focus and get clarity. So when you do show up, the efficiency's already there. You've done the focusing piece and now it's the delivery piece.
And like, let's not pretend this is A, easy, or B, it's like, oh, she turns the light switch on and it just, like, this is a kind of everyday improvement thing. And you get thrown with something or blindsided with something else, and it's really easy for me to revert to the how do I fix it or what do I need to do here. But I like that self-check and also that reflection, being like, oh, Monique, I can see why you did that, but you potentially missed an opportunity here, or what would have it looked like if you'd done this, or how did that feel, and how did it feel for the others?
So that reflective practice, which helps the whole continuous learning, that wasn't what got you to the top. You were the young gun, but now it's like actually the continuous improvement approach is what will sustain you and keep you evolving into the future. Imagine a person who's 29, perhaps it's someone like you, young gun, maybe female, ready to go and make their mark on the world. What do you want them to hear?
I want them to hear that, like, you do you. I received early soundings in my career, and there were people in my career, actually mostly men, who backed me. They took risks on me. They supported me. And maybe it was them I wanted to prove myself to also. But I also had people who were like, oh, so who looks after your children? So, oh, they've got a dad. And I'm pretty good at looking after them too. I just happen to have a job. And I also sometimes sat in rooms where I was like, oh, this room is not for me.
What do you mean by that?
I think I didn't think I was good enough, or I didn't think that the people who I sat in rooms with were not like me.
Yeah.
You know, they had far more years experience in particular. So while we've kind of talked about the ego and maybe my reflection that at times my ego got in the way, I needed my ego to get in the room to back myself and to go on this journey. That whole self-belief is a really key feature of the message I want to give. But be kind to yourself and find those opportunities or moments. I don't want to turn this into kind of a self-care TED talk, because how we look after ourselves is unique to everyone. But what I've really found time and value in is slowing down to have greater impact. And slowing down has mean being more thoughtful, being more deliberate. And when you're building that team of great people, or you're finding your confidence, make the distinction between an ally and a confidant, for starters.
Can you tell us what that means?
Well, I think a confidant is only invested in you. An ally is often, like, they might be your friend and you trust them, or you're working with them every day, but they will have a self-interest in the conversation. So whether it's a mentor or a coach, or whether it's the person that is going to ask you the questions that enables you to reflect in a really vulnerable and thoughtful way that's going to help you round out your ego.
Yeah, a lot of wise advice there.
What would you say to 29-year-old?
Yeah, well, we have interesting parallels. So when I was 29, I became national manager of a recruitment company for a global company, and I was running New Zealand. I had no idea what I was doing.
And Don't tell them that.
Well, it was a long time ago. I think the statute of limitations has passed. But it was a big ego play for me. It was about proving to myself and to my superiors and to the world that I was worthy of this title, you know. And the slowing down is the advice I would give as well, which I'm not sure whether that version of me would have heard, because I was on a mission to make a mark. And the only way I knew how to do that was to go at full tilt. So to hear that advice, I think would have been kind of bouncing off me. The other piece, though, about being kind to myself, I reckon I would have been more open to that. I drove myself really hard and I beat myself up a lot. And what I wish I'd had is someone there by my side, a coach. It's actually what led me into the work I'm doing today, to be the person that's kind of working alongside the people in the heat, you know. And I wish I'd had that person just to help me just see that I wasn't so bad.
Because at the time, those people that you were leading would have been looking at you and demanding perfection. And I particularly found that as a young woman leader, other women in my organizations or even across the sector would often compare themselves to me. They'd absolutely think I had this cape and that I was like the superhero. I have this image that I save on my camera roll because it's a picture of my kitchen floor in our old home where there are kebab sticks and popcorn kernels like all over the floor. And at the time, my nearly 10-year-old, but two-year-old, she'd like climbed up the pantry and the kebab sticks and corn kernels were like freaking everywhere. I always use that as a metaphor where at work or in my role as chief executive, particularly in the early days, like you wanted to give this, everything's fine. Everything is fine. Maybe that's why people, they're like, oh my gosh, she's incredible. And it's like, go home and look at my kitchen floor. Whether it's the kitchen floor, which is, you know, clearly just a metaphor, although that picture's real, to tell a story about like we are real, we're human, we have stuff, which goes to your LinkedIn post. I don't have it all together. I just work really hard every day to make sure the stuff that I need to have it all together on, but that I've got the people around me and the space and pace for me to think and work through that stuff that I don't have it all together on is allowing me to every day be that 1% better version of a leader that I think New Zealand needs, but that I know has an impact beyond just the sector I work in, but more importantly, like the whakapapa, the family that I'm nurturing and building.
Mm-hmm. Space and pace. That's a really good way to put it, you know, and particularly for the stuff we don't have it all together on. It's like, well, give yourself that so you can keep learning. I love that message of, and I'm hoping everyone can hear this and around this, you don't have it all together. Just isn't that a beautiful thing to be able to share? You know, it takes some pressure off all of us, I think. They don't have to be like you in terms of the hero version. Maybe they can be like you in terms of the host version, the one who can is more self-compassionate, will slow down. You know, what if we could learn that lesson a little bit more? Thank you. So I'm sitting here with that. Your language around this is really helpful for me, this idea of space and pace. Just get that right. And I think I'm pretty good at it now. Yet it's that just those little nudges like that, just that language. It's like, okay, have I got enough of that in the week in terms of space? Is the pace about right? I have my practice manager ask me that question at the start of every week. I just have her go, how spacious is your week looking right now? And how are you feeling about that? And that really helps me and her calibrate, because I know I need to build that in. And if I don't have it, then I'm carrying that tension into every meeting, into every interaction. Yeah, that no, when am I going to fit that in, you know? And so deliberately building space in, that's really helpful. Thank you.
I'm probably not as good at it as you, Digby, but I'm getting better. It is a lens that I know is part of the ingredient of how, I'm not going to use the word stay at the top, but how I sustain my leadership legacy.
Beautifully put. There's a question I love to ask at the end of every conversation, which is, what have you learned or been reminded of in our conversation? What's that for you?
Well, I quite like you, Digby. And
Thank you.
Well, otherwise I wouldn't have said yes to this, right? But what I've learned or what I've been reminded of is the joy of connection, the joy in actually not needing an agenda, not needing a script, not even needing really a deadline, but kind of the power of, you know, what can happen through a conversation. I've loved that idea of who were we and who have we become and what will we be, which we've kind of explored through this conversation, has allowed us both to reflect on our individual experiences. So yeah, just thank you for chatting to me. I've enjoyed chatting.
And thank you for going there, and thank you for saying yes. And what I noticed in our conversation, I suspect listeners did as well, was we kind of settled into it. I feel like we got into this groove where we were both going, huh, this is really powerful stuff we're talking about. And there was a dropping of any performative stuff, I think, pretty quickly into actually, yeah, let's wrestle with this. And no, I love that you went deeper there. Thank you. If people want to learn more about you, track you down, connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can message me on LinkedIn. My EA will be like, Monique, how do you do this? We're trying to protect and guard your time. And of course, one of the things I'm working hard at is saying no to things and no to people. But I am deeply passionate about growing a community of people who want to be vulnerable and want to think differently about what the next generation of leadership looks like. So yeah, would love to connect with anyone who wants to have a chat about their journey. I'm really open to that.
Fabulous. Love that. Thanks, Monique. Thank you so much. Leaving here feeling warm, uplifted, thoughtful. It's beautiful.
No, well, thank you.
Just a couple of reflections after that really deep conversation with Monique. Got three things, actually. The first one I was struck by is this idea of creating a culture of curiosity. I think a lot of us like to think that we can do that, but she really demonstrated how to do that well. And essentially it's by, I think, two things. One is asking different questions, like her question, how are you going to feel? You know, she doesn't have the answer to that. She's not looking for the right answer. She's asking people to think. So just asking a different question that makes someone think, I think, is the starting point for that. But also it's about being patient and resisting the urge to jump in to tell people what to think or what to do. And it's kind of sit on your hands. And I could feel her wrestling with that idea, but kind of because she can see the difference it's starting to make. So that's the first one, create a culture of curiosity. The second one is around this idea of having a reflective practice. And, you know, I think in the pressure to be the hero, to be the one with the answers, reflective practice feels like a luxury when you're always on. And she seems to have built in this practice of asking questions like, well, why did I do that? And what did I do well? And what could I do differently next time? And just be able to sit with those questions helps her to be more deliberate and thoughtful, which leads me to the third point, which is this idea of having space and the right pace. And this idea of building in the space to think and to be deliberate, to shape up your thoughts and then to reflect as well. And I reckon that is helped when you decide, well, what is the work that only you can do as a leader? You know, and protect space for that. And the more senior you go, the more often it's less about the doing, as she mentioned, and more about the thinking and the synthesizing of ideas into something potent and focused and powerful. Some reflections there. I wonder what this has got you thinking, what it might encourage you to experiment with. I'm all about experiments, and I hope you're going to take one out of this to try. Also, if this inspired you, I suspect it'll inspire someone else too. Love it if you could share the episode with someone you think would really value hearing it. As ever, love it if you could subscribe, follow on your favorite platform. Thank you to Kane Power for making this sound awesome, and for Gemma Jacob, my new practice manager, for pulling everything together to make this happen. Thank you so much, team. This is Dig Deeper. I'm Digby Scott. Until next time, go well.